Hello, I'm Susan.
Hello, I'm Carol. Welcome to Kickapoo Nightlife, a news program about all things related to the half of every day that is night. We share information about how to protect natural dark night skies with smart lighting developments, explore astronomy events, visit animals, plants, birds, and more as they live in the dark. And we'll share what is being learned about daylight, darkness, and human health. Today, we'll discuss nightlife of some of our fellow residents. But first, a word from our sponsor, Migrating Birds. There are more than 650 species of North American breeding birds. More than half are migratory. Birds migrate for two primary reasons, food and nesting. Birds that nest in the northern hemisphere tend to migrate northward in the spring to take advantage of a large insect populations, budding plants, and an abundance of nesting locations. As winter approaches and the availability of insects and other food drops, the birds move south again. Not all birds migrate, though. Some are permanent residents, like the cardinal. But those birds who do migrate in the fall fall into three categories: short distance, such as the quail; medium distance, like the blue jay, that may move a few hundred miles; and a long distance migrants that move thousands of miles, as do warblers and about 349 other species of birds. While short-distance migration probably developed from fairly simple need for food, the origins of long-distance migration patterns are far more complex. They've evolved over thousands of years and are controlled, at least partially, by the genetic makeup of the birds. They also incorporate responses to weather, geography, food sources, day length, and other factors.
Migrating birds can cover thousands of miles in their annual travels, often traveling the same course year after year with little deviation. First-year birds often make their very first migration on their own. That's pretty amazing, really. Somehow, they can find their winter home despite never having seen it before, and they return the following spring to the place where they were born, just exactly, not the next valley over, but right where they were born. How birds navigate is not fully understood, partly because birds combine several different types of senses when they navigate. Birds can get compass information from the sun, the stars, and by sensing Earth's magnetic fields. They also get information from the position of the setting sun and from landmarks on the ground that they see during the day. There's even evidence some may use a sense of smell in their navigational processes. We sure don't know much about that.
We don't.
Some species, like waterfowls and cranes, follow preferred pathways on their annual migrations. And I think we all have heard of that guy in the ultralight that led the cranes on the migration south a few number of years ago, because they could know exactly where the cranes needed to go so he could lead them.
That was amazing.
Yeah. And also ducks and geese and shorebirds, they used real defined flyways to travel up and down the continent. There's one flyway on each coast, one up the Mississippi River Valley, and one in the center of the continent. And these pathways are often related to important stopover locations that provide food critical to the bird's survival on those long journeys. Terrestrial birds, like songbirds, are much smaller and are not reliant on the same kind of habitats as birds that depend on being near water. There really isn't a narrow migration path for them. More land birds follow different routes in spring and fall. These tiny birds use elliptical routes that take advantage of prevailing wind patterns to save calories.
Land birds fit into three main groups: a western group consisting of 31 species, a central group of 17 species, and 45 species in an eastern group. Their routes are much more spread out across the continent, with routes of the central and eastern groups having considerable overlap. That's why sometimes we will see eastern species here and vice versa. All these species migrate at night at high altitudes where they can't be seen. But when the sun comes up in the morning, they have to find somewhere to roost and feed. Taking a journey that can stretch to a round-trip distance of several thousand miles is a dangerous and arduous undertaking. It is an effort that tests both the bird's physical and mental capabilities. The physical stress of the trip, lack of adequate food supplies along the way, bad weather, and increased exposure to predators all add to the hazard of the journey. In recent decades, long-distance migrants have been facing a growing threat from communication towers and tall buildings. Many species are attracted to the lights of tall buildings, and millions are killed each year in collisions with structures. We've discussed this issue many times, Susan, on this program. Mm-hmm. Additionally, bright lights and the sky glow resulting from them are disorienting and cause confusion regarding night and day and location. Our lighting preferences and actions make a life and death difference for migrating birds. What can we do to help migrating birds make a safe journey? The answer is so simple. Turn off exterior lights when not in use. Close curtains and shades at sundown. Switch our exterior light bulbs to 2200 Kelvin smart lighting and put a cap on the exterior features. How easy is that? How easy is that?
Very, very easy.
If you enjoy watching birds, value their bug-eating capacity and all the other good things they do for us, then take these steps to ensure their health and well-being. Thank you, migrating birds, for all you do for us and for being a sponsor of Kickapoo Nightlife.
And now our phenology calendar for September.
The report for September is up. Autumnal equinox arrives at on September 22nd.
What was that word?
Autumnal?
I'm not sure.
Autumnal. I think it's autumnal equinox arrives on September 22nd when the hours of day and night are equal, officially signaling the first day of fall. Across Wisconsin, deciduous leaves are changing color and begin to fall. Tamarack tree needles are turning yellow and will eventually drop. Katydids, grasshoppers, crickets, and cicada have stopped whining in the evening air. Birds are migrating. Watch and listen for Canada geese. White-tailed bucks rub off the velvet from their antlers to prepare for the rut. Mosquitoes begin to disappear. Hurrah!
Yeah.
Beavers re-insulate their lodges with mud and branches and stash tasty birch and aspen branches for winter meals. 13-lined ground squirrels and gray squirrels fatten up for a long winter's nap by eating nuts from trees. Hawks gather in migrating groups along northern lake shores and southern prairies. Later this month, Chinook salmon start spawning. It's a good time for fish watching. Tiger salamanders migrate to wintering sites like logs, the foundation of buildings, and gopher mounds.
And I would make a note about that salmon comment, because I had no idea there were salmon in this part of the world. And you said they have been introduced into these rivers in Minnesota or Iowa?
In Minnesota and some in here in Wisconsin,
yeah,
too.
And that was news to me. So I wonder how many other people don't realize there are actually salmon in the area. That's really quite something.
I think a lot of the true fisher people
are
into it, you know, because salmon are really a variety of trout.
Yeah, right.
And, you know, this is trout country.
But I think it's pretty special to have salmon, yeah. So now we're going to move on to our calendar of events. In September, the Kickapoo Valley Dark Sky Initiative monthly board of directors meeting is Wednesday the 3rd, and that's the day after tomorrow at 6:30 p.m. at the Kickapoo Valley Reserve. For information or a Zoom link to the meeting, contact info@fourdarkskies.org, and that's the number 4darkskies.org. Saturday the 6th, Wildcat Mountain State Park hosts a night walk under an almost full moon to enjoy the moon, the stars, and the forests and fields after dark. Starting at 8 p.m., the walk is 1.4 miles on mostly level terrain. Registration is required. And I will be at that walk, and so will Marla Lind, I believe, and I'm not sure who else. So you call 608-337-4775 to register. That's Wildcat Mountain State Park. The Wisconsin Dark Sky Organization monthly meeting is Wednesday, September 17th at 6:30 p.m. For a Zoom link to join them and find out about dark sky news around Wisconsin, contact wisconsin@darksky.org. The night of September 17th, there will be a partial eclipse of the moon starting at 7:41 Central Daylight Time. That's shortly after moonrise. At its peak, 8% of the moon will be covered by the penumbral shadow, giving the moon a red or orange shadow for just over an hour. A lot of times people don't pay attention to these little eclipses, and they can be quite beautiful. So if the sky is clear at all, make a point of trying to go out and see that beautiful moon showing. The autumn equinox, the first day of fall, is September 22nd at 8:19 p.m. So that's the things to pay attention to and go out and enjoy in September. You are listening to WDRT 91.9 FM in Viroqua, Wisconsin. Today, we're going to be exploring what our fellow residents do at night. In the dark, in the woods, the fields, streams, and ponds of our shared home here in the hills and valleys of the Kickapoo River watershed. While we live inside our self-made buildings, our neighbors of other species have a very different experience. Maybe you'll be surprised by what their lives are like after dark. First, we're visiting the last of the land's gardens and prairie flowers. And we're going to look at moths and butterflies that live into the fall. Most of what we know about moths relate to what we see in the fields and gardens during the day. And we focus on those that either are very beautiful and we enjoy them, or we think they're bad because they eat our crops when there's not enough natural food for them. But people who study moths and butterflies find there's interesting behaviors that we can't know about when we only see them on our garden flowers. There's about 17,500 species of butterflies that we know about, but there's at least 160,000 species of moths that we know about. There could be hundreds of thousands more that humans haven't identified yet, so there's a lot of them out there. The few we're discussing today may represent behaviors countless others also do, but we're not aware of it yet. Moths and some butterflies pollinate many plants at night. Sometimes they provide the majority of pollination services for some species of plants. Some plants produce pollen during the day that's dependent on the amount of time moths and butterflies visit the flowers at night. Few visits mean less pollen and nectar the next day for the day-feeding insects. So there's a whole cycle of day-night activity and relationships going on that are essential for both the insects and the plants. Moths and butterflies also migrate at night just like the birds do. hummingbird hawk moths can fly 30 miles an hour, and they go a long ways during a night's flight. Many species, including what we call corn earworms, and that's a Helicoverpa zea species, travel a mile or more above the earth when they're migrating. Some of them are 2 or more miles high when they're actually traveling long distances, and we think there's many species that actually fly quite high. They use the winds aloft to conserve their energy. Moths and butterflies have been found to be migrating over mountain ranges. They can adjust their course for headwinds and crosswinds and tailwinds. So as they travel, they're using more than just a magnetic orientation or visual orientation to reach their destination. There's a moth in Australia called the bogong moth, and there's been quite a few articles in various news sources about this moth in the past few years. It travels over 600 miles using the stars and the Earth's magnetic field to navigate. So we know they navigate at night almost exclusively. Prometheus moths use the Earth's magnetic field to navigate, and that's a moth that we have around here. It's a large, beautiful moth, and maybe many of our listeners would have seen one at one point in time. The females fly at night, and the males are active in the daylight. But both male and female are active for a few hours right at twilight. So that's when they mate, and that may also be a time that the females would begin their migration. Painted lady butterflies are found all over the world, and some migrate from Northern Europe to Central Africa. Here in the U.S., they're known to move north and south depending on temperature. So they can fly over large ocean areas, especially that European migration, and they fly at really high altitudes too, using the winds aloft. I think this is so interesting about Luna moths. I read that Luna moths have these beautiful long green tails that you've seen if you've ever seen a Luna moth, but the edges of these tails on their wings have a ruffled or wavy edge, and they have the skill of spinning these long tails around and around. That confuses bat echolocation. And the longer the tail is, the more effective it is in protecting the moth from bats. So I think that's a real inspiration to take a closer look at a lot of these other night-flying insects. What strategies might they have going on that we can't imagine?
Advanced technology.
Well, it really is, isn't it? Sophisticated engineering. There's a moth called the death's head hawk moth because it has a mark on its back that people think looks like a skull. And it vibrates. I think I can say this on the radio.
Okay.
It vibrates its genitals to disrupt bat echolocation. So the more you look, the stranger things get flying around out there at night. Moths have been seen drinking the tears of animals as they sleep. Now that's kind of something out of Midnight Summer's Dream.
Yes,
that's right.
Midsummer
Night's Dream. I think of that just because I saw it recently, but that's a very magical, fairy-like sort of thing.
Yes, it is.
The moisture that collects around the eyes of a variety of animals is moisture that has minerals and salts that these moths and butterflies need, and it's an easy way for them to get it. So they will land at the eyes of sleeping animals and lap up that tea that is the tears. And they've been seen doing that around the eyes of birds, turtles, and even crocodiles. There's so much we don't know. Ichneumonid wasp, which we know as a beneficial parasitic wasp, they only fly at night. It takes patience and careful observation to view these creatures in the dark and to leave them undisturbed so they can carry on their lives. I'm impressed with what we've learned about such tiny, quick-moving, hard-to-see creatures. But these insects, like so many others, are disappearing because of human interference in nature's balance. We need these little creatures to pollinate food crops and to be food for so many birds and amphibians and reptiles and mammals. These creatures, in turn, have an essential role in life support for the rest of us. It's easy to take a long time and explore all kinds of things about what insects are doing with their lives after dark, but I'll end by saying, if you're interested in giving moths and butterflies a chance, plant some native flowering plants and flowers that bloom at twilight and at night, and change your outdoor lights to 2200 Kelvin and shield them to prevent glare. And then my suggestion is get your lawn chair out in their yard, tuck yourself in, and wait for your visitors to flit by and enjoy the beautiful, moving color and light. It's not really light, but a color show in your garden as they help your plants grow and fly to their next destination.
That was fascinating.
Isn't that
Susan?
Amazing? Some
it
of that
just
stuff.
Amazing.
I never knew some of that. Yeah.
Yes, it is.
Yeah.
They really are fly-by-night insects.
Yeah.
Well, Susan, I've been really interested in the issue of darkness and amphibians.
Yeah, I am too. So what did you find out?
Yeah, it's just crucial for amphibians, especially nocturnal species, as it directly impacts their survival, reproduction, and overall well-being. Something that I found out was that many amphibians are nocturnal to avoid diurnal predators that rely on sight for hunting. Darkness provides cover, making them harder for predators to detect and catch.
So like a hawk wouldn't catch a lizard because it couldn't see it.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. And I'm not sure that owls give a hoot about them.
No, I don't. Maybe not.
Maybe not. The other thing is amphibians breathe through their skin, making them prone to drying out. Nocturnal activity, when temperatures are cooler and humidity is higher, helps them to avoid desiccation, a loss of water from sun and heat. Mm. And I found that fabulous. And what great planning Mother Nature had for them. Mm-hmm. Did you know that many frogs and toad species rely on nighttime calling and specific environmental cues related to darkness for successful breeding?
The darkness, not the temperature.
No, the darkness.
Oh.
Artificial light at night can disrupt this process by interfering with their calls and altering their breeding rituals. That was really something, because I really thought that it had far more to do with temperature. But
yeah, but if it's as simple as there's a light on and they can't call, so they don't reproduce, and then we wonder why there's hardly any frogs anymore, the fix is so simple.
Absolutely, yeah. It is. Another thing is nocturnal amphibians are adapted for hunting and foraging in low light conditions. Exposure to light, artificial light at night, can impact their ability to find food, potentially leading to reduced foraging efficiency and affecting their nutritional intake. The natural cycle of light and dark regulates their circadian rhythms of plants and animals, governing essential behaviors like reproduction, nourishment, and sleep. Artificial light at night can disrupt these rhythms, affecting the amphibian's physiology and potentially leading to increased stress levels.
Well, probably not potentially. We always have to say that, but really, it for sure.
Yes. You know, so we start looking at the long-term consequences of disrupted circadian rhythms in amphibians. And this has a significant and concerning long-term consequence, especially given their reliance on darkness for critical life functions. It impairs reproduction. It also impairs, affects developmental abnormalities. Research indicates that disruption during early life stages, including altered light environments, can have lasting impacts on development and behavior. I had this interesting research if I can find it here. Oh, yeah, here it is. I read this interesting research study. It was done at the Binghamton University by Assistant Professor of Biological Sciences, Jessica Hua. And it was done in 2019. And it studied exposed wood frogs to a controlled and to anthropogenic light conditions, which means intensified daylight illuminance and artificial light at night. It was found that both the intensified daytime light exposure and the artificial light at night exposure decreased hatching success in tadpoles. Additionally, tadpoles that did hatch were reared in artificial light at night were larger, less active, more sensitive to road salt pollution, and more parasites. You'd think that a larger tadpole would be better, but what they found is that it decreased their activity and made them sensitive to all different kinds of things.
Yeah, that idea that bigger makes it stronger or better is almost never true in nature.
That's right. Yeah. That's right. Yeah. It's not, bigger is not necessarily better.
No.
Disrupted circadian rhythms can affect foraging and efficiency, activity levels, and stress responses, potentially impacting growth rates and ultimately survival. And this was really interesting. Juvenile toads exposed to artificial light at night showed increased nocturnal activity, potentially expending more energy and leading to reduced growth rates.
Hyperactive kids?
Yeah.
Hyperactive toad kids?
Basically.
Yeah, they're overstimulated. Is that what they're saying?
Yeah. In the study in 2018, it was published in the Proceedings of the Royal Society of London. It was the study to determine the impacts of artificial light on larval and juvenile American frogs or toads. They did not find any significant impact of artificial light on larval growth or behavior, but in juvenile American toads were significantly affected. The juvenile toads under artificial light at night exposure were more active than those with darkness and had a growth rate 15% lower than those in dark exposure. This increase of nocturnal activity by juveniles under artificial light conditions appears to have resulted in increased energy expenditure and thus growth rates. You know, this is all just so fascinating. And I got just tons of interesting research here, Susan. But understanding the consequences of the loss of dark skies is crucial for developing effective conservation strategies to protect these vulnerable species from the impacts of increasing urbanization and light pollution. And I hope that in the future we're going to continue talking about these different species and the effects of darkness.
Yes, I can think of some information on salamanders that was really interesting a few years ago. But basically the takeaway is when you disrupt nature's patterns, a lot of things get disrupted along with it. It's not a benign thing to do, even if we haven't noticed it all yet.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So there's still a lot of beautiful things out there. We want you to go out and enjoy them, but that's all the information we've got today about all those critters at night. There's a lot more of them out there, and we're going to continue to watch them and let you know what we find out. So it's a great time to be out observing birds.
And it's an excellent time for us to be watching for birds and remembering the many butterflies and moths who migrate too. So watch for them. For these days, when so many of our woodland and forest friends are trying to find their way under difficult conditions, please turn out your lights.
I'm Susan.
And I'm Carol.
See you next time.